James Bibles, and I'm an alcoholic. By the grace of God and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't found a need or an excuse to take a drink today. Nor have I found a need or an excuse to take a drink since May 28th, 1973, and for that I'm truly grateful. I'm a member of the Alcoholic Olsons from Madison, Wisconsin. We've been putting people into insane asylums, jails, and early graves ever since we got here from Norway. So the last one before me was my father, who died from this disease or complications of this disease. And I'm the first one in our family who ever survived it. So I went to Alcoholics Anonymous starting in 1968. I just couldn't get it. I'd go to Alcoholics Anonymous and I'd walk in and I knew I had a degenerative and fatal disease, and I knew it was going to kill me. And I'd go in there looking for an answer, and somebody would look at me and say, "Well, don't drink and you won't get drunk." And I would say, "So you really don't know how to do this either, right?" And they'd go, "Well, keep coming back." And I'd go, "What the hell for?" You know, it was really frustrating for me because I knew what was going to happen as a direct result of this. I mean, it wasn't only my experience, it was watching my family. And I just wanted somebody to tell me what the hell to do. I was desperate. I knew that the end was coming, and I didn't know when that was going to happen. And I didn't know when to turn, but I was fairly certain I'd never live past 35. No way in hell I'd live past 35. And I knew that there was an answer in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I just flat couldn't get to it. Now, part of that was because I always went to meetings drunk. And it was kind of a funny deal because I'd go in there and people would stroke you and they would tell you everything was going to be cool. And I knew it was a lie. I mean, I knew I was going to get drunk on the way home. But I'd go there and it was like turning myself in. And I'd figure I did my duty and I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now I could go out and get drunk and that was the end of that. And that's what I did. In 1973, I went on some, it wasn't unusual. I was an everyday drinker. I drank a lot, every day. And I went on some, my wife left me. We had two sons and she took both those kids and went to France. And I went on a bender and I was gone for like 2 or 3 days, and I know that I must have stopped. I was in a blackout, a lot of that. And I know I must have stopped at my parents' house, or my mother's house, which is in my stepfather's house, because something happened there. And I'm not even sure to this day exactly where it was, but it wasn't pleasant. And then I got back in this little house that I lived in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. And that's the last I remember. And the next thing I knew, I was looking up at two members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was laying on the floor. And there was a guy that was like 3 or 4 years sober that had been my sponsor on my brief occasions in Alcoholics Anonymous. He was there. And he had this new guy, and the new guy was dancing around me. And he was going, "Oh, my God, oh, my God, what are we going to do? Is he going to go into DTs? can we give him something? Should we call the doctor? Do we need an ambulance? What are we going to do? And he's jumping around and jumping around. If I would have had a gun, I would have shot this son of a bitch. And he was appropriately named Dick. And they said, we're going to take you down to this halfway house. And they took me to this place, and it was run by a Catholic priest. That shouldn't be too big a deal, except I was brought up a German Lutheran. And those two people don't mix. Okay? And they sat me down in front of this guy with a collar, and I thought, here we go. And it's funny how you can be dying right in front of somebody and still want to fight. And they put me in front of this priest, and he said, are you an alcoholic? And I said, for God's sake, they just carried me in here. And he said, are you done? And good question. I said, I don't know. And he said, why not? And I said, I can't stop. And he said, you can't stop? And I said, no. And he said, well, I got some bad news for you. And I said, what's that? And he said, we can't stop you either. And I said, you can't? And see, my mind is screaming, then what the hell am I doing here? And he said, no, we can't stop you. There aren't enough people in this city to stop you if you want another drink. And I said, okay. And I'm figuring that's the end of the story. If I can't stop and they can't stop, that's the end of the deal. And he said, do you believe in God? And I thought I'd irritate him. And I said, no, I don't. And he said, well, looks like you're out of luck. Not exactly like that. He said something else, which I thought was wholly inappropriate for a priest. And I said, why is that? And he said, because if you can't stop yourself, and we can't stop you, if there isn't a God, game's over. And I said, I wouldn't even know where to go look. And he said, we're going to send you home. And I went, huh. You know, I'd been drinking a fifth a day for so long, and I had been in DTs before. And I knew what was going to happen if they sent me home. And they didn't have any treatment centers. And they didn't know what the heck to do with you. You know, they were just getting over using pyraldehyde back then. And he said, well, I suggest you go find a God that you can believe in. And I said, I don't know how to do that. You know, the most I know about finding God is now I lay me down to sleep. And he said, well, see if you can find a God that you'd like. And I said, isn't that a little presumptuous? Me deciding what God is? And he said, why don't you just do what I ask you to do? And when you come back, tell me what you came up with. And I said, okay. And then they took me home. And that's what they used to do. And they left me in an empty house, and I knew what was coming. And it did. I got to tell you that spending 72 hours flopping around like a fish out of water, having hallucinations and DTs, and knowing every minute of that 72 hours that you're going to die in the next minute is an experience that you really don't want to repeat. I saw things coming out from under my refrigerator that you don't even see on Saturday morning cartoons. I saw ants that were as big as this podium coming out from under my refrigerator. And I had three cans arrayed in the basement stairwell, and I was trying to kill these giant ants with these raid cans, and I goddamn near asphyxiated myself. And when it was all over, they came back to see if I was still there. And then they took me to a meeting, and took me back and set me in front of this priest, and they said, and this priest said, what do you think about God? And I said, you know, I've been talking to God a lot, but I don't know how to make him listen. So I did it standing and sitting and on my knees and in Old English and New English and any, because I didn't know how to make that happen. And he said, you don't have to do all that stuff. And I said, well, you know, I don't know what to do. And he said, why don't you just talk to God like you talk to anybody else? And I said, okay. And he said, what would you like God to be? And I said, I'd like God to be like a dad. I'd like him to be like a father. I grew up without one, basically. And I would like him to be gentle. And I don't like the idea of God running around with lightning bolts. Because God knows I deserved one. And, you know, it's lucky that we don't get what we deserve. Because this room would be empty. Okay? So he said, you know, God the Father is an old concept that's always held up by most major religions. And I like the idea about a gentle father sort of guiding you through life. And one that really couldn't get too mad. And one that wasn't going to beat you up just because you stepped out of line. Okay? And so he said, I think that's a good idea and why don't you believe in that? And I said, all right. And so I went off to become a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was so afraid. I had reached a point that the book describes as not being able to take another drink or it would kill me. And this isn't an exaggeration. If I took another drink, it would have killed me. And if I, whoops, there's a little fly flying around here. And if I did take another drink, it would kill me. And if I didn't take another drink, it would kill me. And when you reach that point, there is no hope. You have to drink and you can't drink. And there's nothing else to do. I mean, where do you go from there? So I had reached, and I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and really hoped that this worked. But it hadn't worked for me before that. I kind of knew that there was something here that might work. I had tried and tried, and I'm a fairly bright person, and I couldn't find it. So what I did was I went to meetings, and I tried to help other people. And I did that for a year. And I got sicker and sicker, and I was an unrecovered alcoholic. And I just kept going downhill. And my life got more insane and more insane. And I wasn't drinking. You know, there are very few things that are worse than being an alcoholic, not having a drink, and not having a solution. In the middle of all that, I'd gone to work for a company in Wisconsin, the West Bend Company, and they had moved me to Denver. And I'd gone to a meeting at the York Street Club in Denver one night on a Sunday night. And I was listening to this guy talk, and he started talking about stuff I'd never heard of before. I mean, I'd been around AA for a year already, and I'd never heard any of this stuff. And frankly, maybe it's because I couldn't hear it, but I don't think so. You know, the AA that I was used to was, you go get drunk, we'll go get you out of the bar, bring you back, babysit you. And then I'll go get drunk, and then you go to the bar and come in and babysit me, and then he goes out and gets drunk, and we go to the bar, bring you back, babysit him. And that was, and see, when you do that in Alcoholics Anonymous, you get convinced that at some point your number's coming up. That it's some sort of devilish lottery, and every once in a while it comes up. And that means you go off, and if you survive it, then your buddies go out and get you and bring you back. And that's what I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was in Denver. I'd moved there, and I was listening to this guy on a Sunday night, and he started talking about that part in the beginning of the book that says, to show others precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. And this guy got up there and said there was a specific set of instructions in that book that if you followed, you not only didn't have to ever take a drink again, you didn't have to want to take a drink. And that's what grabbed me. Because I had been dragged around by a compulsion to drink ever since I could remember. And he's talking about salvation. He's talking about living a whole different life. And I'm sitting there and I am glued to everything he's saying. And I believe that I'd never heard that before. And all of a sudden someone presented me with the solution. And I grabbed him after the meeting and said, "What in heaven's name are you talking about?" And he said, "Well, it's right in the book." And I said, "Really?" And he said, "Haven't you ever read the big book?" And I went, "No." And he said, "Well, tell me what you have done." And I said, "Okay, well, you know, I haven't had a drink since May of 1973, and I go to meetings, and I try and be a really good person. And I, you know, if somebody needs some kind of help, I'll go over and volunteer." And he looked at me and he said, "Well, Bob, it looks like you did everything but follow the directions." You know, that kind of comment would make me mad today. But it didn't make me mad then because I didn't know what the directions were. And so I said, "I don't know how to do that." And he said, "Do you need a sponsor?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, I'll help you, but it means that you have to make a commitment. And you come over to my house once a week and we'll spend a couple hours together and we will start at the forward to the first edition. And we will read everything in that book. And when it says to do something, you're going to do it. And if it says pray, you will pray. And if it says make a decision, you will make a decision. And if it says you go make amends to someone else, you will go make amends to someone else. And if you don't want to do that, get out of my life." Okay. So I went and did that. And you know, I just got started. And he was asking me, you know, I've never had any doubts about my alcoholism. Geez, I mean, it's, I drank too much. I did too much. I started drinking when I was 17. I was a pretty good guy up until I was 17. And I have a violent personality change and I become what the book calls dangerously antisocial. When I drank, I had a radical personality change. I used to watch my dad go through that. I mean, he'd be a really nice guy, and the next thing you knew, he's punching somebody's lights out. And I was 17 when I started drinking, and up until then, I was president of the Luther League, and I was junior vice president of the class, and I started junior achievement in my hometown, and did all this different stuff that was civic and... And I started drinking when I was 17. By the time I was coming up on my 18th birthday, I was sentenced to 4 years in the Wisconsin State Penitentiary for assault with a deadly weapon. Gee, how'd that happen? Nice guy like me? And fortunately, I got out of it. And I became, I became the poster boy for the Walworth County Probation Department. we were working on the first step, and I, the book says we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we're alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we're like other people or presently may be, which means or ever will be, has to be smashed. You know what? I'm not like other people. I'm an alcoholic. I am a burning, dyed-in-the-wool alcoholic, and I'm just like my forebears. I start drinking and there is no way to stop. I do not have the power to shut that thing off. I don't have a problem with the first step. I think some people do. I got to tell you, my experience is I got dragged around almost all of my adult life until I got sober by a bottle of alcohol. Everything I did was based around where the next drink was coming from. And when I took a drink, I had a violent personality change and bad stuff started to happen. I used to go into bars, actually into restaurants with bars, with my first wife. I've only had two. I don't have either one anymore, but I did have two. Well, it just didn't take. So, I'd go sit in that bar and I'd have three or four drinks and I'd see somebody and I just hated them. And I'd never seen them before. And they'd be sitting there having dinner with their family or something and I'd go into a rage about some person I'd never see before. That's insane. And I'd go over and invite them outside. And my poor wife would look at me and go, "Please, Bob, don't do that." And it's just that's alcoholic insanity. When we got to the second step, my sponsor was, he asked me if I believed in God, and I said, you know, my experience so far is that I don't have to take a drink anymore, and somehow that, I don't know how that's been relieved, and I believe that's a God. I choose to do that. I don't have the proof. I just choose to believe it. And the book says that if you're even willing to believe, upon this simple cornerstone, a wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built. And, you know, I just became willing to believe. You don't have to know. That's why there's so many groups across the country that are called mustard seed. Because a mustard seed is so small you can't hardly see it. And that's all you need is one tiny grain of faith that there might possibly be a God. It's enough to get started with. Okay? I remember this priest became a good friend of mine, the guy who ran a halfway house. And he'd say, "Are you learning how to trust God?" And I went, "Well, I trust him. You know, I'll give him like 4 hours in the morning. If he doesn't screw up, I can give him the rest of the day." I didn't come to this gladly. That's how crazy it was when I got started, because it was just like, no. And my sponsor was sitting there telling me, "Well, gee, Bob, you know, almost anybody could run your life better than you do. So why wouldn't you let God run it?" And I'd go, "Because I don't know what he's up to." There's a funny thing in the book there. It starts talking about power. And if you want to check that out sometime, I never met a drunk that wasn't interested in power. So... it talks about, it defines the power. It says that power which is God. So if you run into somebody in a group that says that they're worshiping a tree or a doorknob or something, I would get them institutionalized as quickly as possible. The book talks about it says that when we become willing to believe in a God, it says we feel new power flowing in. And then, when it talks about making God the central fact in our lives, it says that we get power, peace, happiness, and a sense of direction. Now, I got to tell you, that's all I've ever wanted out of life. That's everything. Power, peace, happiness, direction. And we can have that by making God the central fact in our lives. Now, there is the opposite side of that equation in that part of the book also, and it's called the bedevilments. And that's the things that say, if you read that, it's about not being of real help to other people, being prey to misery and depression. There's a whole litany of bad things that can happen to us. And that has to do with not having God the central fact in our lives. You know, when I, today, even with this amount of sobriety, if I kind of go off the deep end, if I start really getting terribly frustrated with life and start getting paranoid about what's going on around me or whatever, that's where the problem is. Okay? I can go back to that. In the second step, I can go back to the point where I say, well, God must no longer be the central fact in my life. And you want to know that the book talks in that part of the book, it starts talking about the worship of other things. Okay? And I worship all kinds of things. I mean, I'll worship money, position, sex. I'll worship everything but God. And what I will do is I will give those things priority over God. And then my life goes right straight in the toilet. And I know how to get out of it. It's coming back, throwing myself at God's feet again and saying, sorry, I didn't know what I was doing. I need some help here. And this is the only place I can find it. Do you know, I have never, ever met anyone who would turn to God unless they had no other alternative. Okay? We don't. If we have one other thing we can do, if we have one other direction that we can turn in, if we have one other lie that we can try and rely on, we will never, ever turn to God. Wouldn't it be nice if we just turned around and said, okay, God, but that isn't the way our minds work. We go, I'll fix it. Okay? Stay over there, I'll take care of it. And then when you're just beaten bloody and you have no place to turn, then we will turn back to God and go, sorry. One of the things in the book that talks about alcoholism is his business about being crushed by a self-imposed crisis. The book says, crushed by a self-imposed crisis, we could neither postpone nor evade. We had to fearlessly face the proposition that God either is or he isn't. He's either everything or he's nothing. What is your choice to be? My self-imposed crisis isn't my alcoholism. My self-imposed crisis is that I can't stop it. I have alcoholism and it's killing me and I can't do anything about it. That's the crisis. The crisis is, okay, but I don't know where to go with this. And I can't postpone it. I can't go, I'm really sick, you got to give me a month off. Okay? And I can't evade it. I can't come to Fresno and leave my alcoholism in Centennial. I just can't do it. Okay? My alcoholism comes right with me. So that's one of those deals about I can't fix myself. And I need to understand who's God and who's the drunk. Okay? And I sometimes get the idea that I can fix this stuff, and there is no fixing this stuff. So we had to fearlessly face the proposition that God either is or he isn't. You want to know the truth? I believe that God is. I have an absolutely unshakable faith that God is. I've always known. You know what? There are too many circumstances in my life that can't be circumstances. There are too many miraculous things that have happened in the last 31 years. And I know that there has to be a God because that can't happen. Okay? And those kinds of miracles have happened in my life over and over and over again. And I couldn't go from being a chronic, knockdown, drag out, gutter drunk and get to where I am today. You want to hear something really funny? I told you I would get sentenced to the Department of Corrections in Wisconsin. Today I am the largest provider of therapy services to the Colorado Department of Corrections. And just dumb old me has psychiatrists and psychologists and social workers and professional counselors and all these different people working for me. Okay? My company. How the hell did that happen? I thought, you know, in the Department of Corrections, I used to train them in business skills. I train them in time management and things like that because I did a lot of that as a corporate trainer. And then all of a sudden they asked me to get into therapy and I said, no thanks. And they said, why not? And I said, I don't believe in it. And they said, we don't care. We like doing business with you. And I went, okay. And then I got in business, and people go, you're in a business you don't much believe in, right? And I went, uh-huh. And they said, how's that happen? I said, it's God's sense of humor. And it is God's sense of humor. And you want to know the truth? People who work for me really do a good job, and their heart's in the right place, and I think they make a difference. And my bias has nothing to do with that. Okay? It's just God's sense of humor. About the time when we got to the third step was in 1975, and then there was an international convention that came to Denver, and there were 17,000 drunks in this one room with the biggest coffee maker in the world. It was. There's this big, I can't remember what they, there was this big building, a convention center, and it had a balcony that went all the way around the top of it. And they put a pipe all the way around the top of that thing, and it had like 320 spigots on it or something like that, and they piped hot coffee through it. Isn't that amazing? It was the largest coffee maker in the world. And it was for AA. Okay? And you know, Lois Wilson was there, absolutely just brought everybody to tears. And there was a guy there who is dead now that was from Winnipeg. His name was Mac Cheater. And Mac Cheater got up and gave a talk about a group in Winnipeg called the Golden Slippers. And the reason why they called them the Golden Slippers was because they couldn't stay sober. And they were all slippers. And he said, you know, we didn't know what to do. Because everybody kept going out and drinking, and some of them were going out and drinking and dying. You know, Ontario, Winnipeg is not a good place to go out in the winter and get drunk. Because on a warm day, it's 20 below. Okay, so you don't want to fall down in an alley. Because they're going to find you. You're going to be an icicle by the time they find you. And so he said they didn't know what to do. Everybody just kept getting drunk, and it was awful. And they were trying to find a solution to it. So they made a decision as a group. And the decision was that they weren't going to talk about the steps anymore. And they weren't going to rationalize about the steps anymore. And they weren't going to intellectualize about the steps anymore. They were just going to do the steps. And the most amazing thing happened. They stayed sober. They did what my sponsor suggested to me. They started at the forward to the first edition, and that whole group went through and they did everything that it said to do. And they didn't drink anymore. And one of the neatest experiences in my life was about 10 years ago when I got to go back to Winnipeg. And I got to get up there and give them the message that they had given us. And what a wonderful thing to do. I have been blessed, truly blessed in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you will be too. And there really are miracles that happen here, and I don't know how to explain that any better. On my anniversary, my 31st birthday was last week, Friday. And the day before, I get a package in the mail. And from this lady on the East Coast. And I open it up, and there's one of these in there. Okay? I open it up, and I thought, wow, this is a second edition. What a nice thing for somebody to do. And there was a note in there that said, thank you for the help, because I'd helped this lady through the steps. And she said, I want you to have this book. And I thought, how nice. And then I opened the book up like this, and right here it says, Always Bill. And it was signed by Bill Wilson. And I thought, what an absolutely magnificent gift. And I, you know what? If you stick around here long enough, and you do this stuff long enough, that stuff is going to happen to you. And it's just going to happen. And I don't want to sell you on Alcoholics Anonymous, but I got to tell you, this is truly miraculous. And the only thing that it requires is engaging in the process. And my sponsor explained to me that as long as I put no poetic license into this process, as long as I did it exactly as it was outlined in the book, that my life would change and it would become better than anything I would have ever given myself. So we're listening to Max Cheater talk about this, and there are about 15 of us, so let's go do that. And that was just up to the third step of my sponsor, and he and I were both part of this group, and so we went in there and we started back at one and went through two again, and then we got to three, and it starts talking about selfishness, self-centeredness that we think is the root of our problem. And I'm sitting there, and my sponsor is telling me, you know that that's alcoholism. And I said, no, it isn't. And he said, yeah, it is. That's your alcoholism. And I said, no. My alcoholism is I see a bottle of booze, and I pick it up, and I can't stop drinking it. That's my alcoholism. And he said, no, it isn't, Bob. Your alcoholism is selfishness and dishonesty and resentment and fear. And I went, uh-uh. And he said, well, just bear with me, okay? Driven by 100 forms of fear, all right? You think, well, I'll talk about that in a while, but you think we aren't driven by 100 forms of fear? I've never met an alcoholic who wasn't terrified. I mean it. You know, I was a bill collector in Chicago, okay? I was a 240-pound psychopath. And I used to go kick in people's doors and bang them up against the wall and tell them, give me the money or I'm coming back and I'm going to start to break things. And your legs would probably be the first to go. And just insane. We read about selfishness and self-centeredness, and then the book says that it shows the prayer, and my sponsor had me read this prayer: God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help with thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. You notice there's no amen on the end of that? It's because the end of the prayer is until the end of the seventh step. So he said, that's the deal. You offer yourself to God, and he can do anything with you that he wants. And I went, yeah, I don't think so. Relieve me of the bondage of self. You know, my bondage is really self. Do you know that the bondage of self is like having a periscope aimed at your own forehead? That's the bondage of self, being chained to this periscope, and you can't see anything but yourself. Okay? And because you don't ever do anything but look at yourself, you start pole vaulting over mouse turds. We get so focused on ourselves that everything's a great big deal. Do you ever notice why there's so much drama around Alcoholics Anonymous? Jesus, it drives me nuts. Okay? It's all drama. And it all is meaningless. The trick is to turn the periscope out so I can see you without looking at me. Because if I filter everything through me, it isn't going to come out right. Take away my difficulties. A victory over them may bear witness. That means being an example. Okay? May bear witness to those I would help about thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. So let people look at me and know that in 1973, I was a knockdown, drag-out, fifth-a-day, gutter drunk with no future, no friends, no place to go, and a likely candidate for an early grave in the next 60 days. And look at the difference. Okay? I'm not any kind of different miracle than you are. I mean, I don't, you know, see, you have some choices when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and the choices are these. You get to choose who you are, what you are, what your principles are, and who your friends are. Those are all your choices, and if you don't choose that, somebody else will choose them for you. How long have you walked around having somebody else tell you who you are? Okay? I don't let people tell me who I am. I get to choose. God gave me that choice. I have become the person that I wanted to be. And you may not think that I shot very high. Okay? So you want to know the truth? I am who I want to be. And it's always been my choice. And God has given me that choice and the help in becoming that. And I chose to be just a stand-up person. And I chose to live by a set of principles, and I wrote them down. I wrote down the things that I believed in, okay, and how I wanted my life to proceed. And that's, and I don't do that perfectly, but that's pretty much how I live today. And you have the same choice. And see, most people go through their whole lives without ever determining who and what they're going to be. What they want to be, how they want to live. You know, other people can come up and tell me whatever they want about who they think I am, but that's who they want me to be. I get to choose who I am. The problem with not making those choices is if somebody else comes, if you haven't made that choice and somebody comes up and tells you who you are, you're going to believe them. And then you're always going to be disappointed. Because most of the time when people tell you who they want you to be, they're mad. And then they're going to tell you that something demeaning. And if you think that you're walking through life just being an excuse or a bad person or whatever, probably time for you to take a look. Okay? Now, how do you get to this? By doing this over and over and over again. I have written inventory and gone through the steps once a year for 31 years. And I have no visible scars. Okay? So, you know what? I know what I believe, and it's based on my experience. And you can have the same experience, and there is absolutely nothing special about me. And I just got through a few minutes before this meeting having a conversation about God loves me a bunch. And you want to know something? He loves you as much as He loves me. And don't you kind of wonder what you could be? Didn't you ever really wonder what you had the capacity to be? Most people will never challenge that. We live a life of fear. And most people are so locked in place that they can never, ever become the person that they dream to be. And the truth is that if you will engage in the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, that fear, which will steal virtually everything in your life, will no longer have that effect on you. Because you find out that the things that we spend most of the time being afraid of never happen. When I went to make my third step, you know, when we do a third step, we get on our knees with our sponsor, hold hands and say the prayer and mean it. And so my sponsor said, well, come on over next week, a week from today. I want you to consider this because, you know, you're making the deal about God gets to do anything with you He wants. And I said, okay. And he said, come back in a week, and if you want to do it, you get on your knees, you memorize that prayer, and we'll say it and move on. And I said, okay. And I went back the next week, and he said, well, you want to do it? And I said, no. And he said, why not? And I said, because I don't want to give God that kind of power in my life. And he said, well, then I don't think we have anything else to talk about. And I said, well, I didn't say I wasn't going to do it. I just said I didn't want to do it. So he said, well, then get on your knees with me and say the prayer. And I said, okay. And I got on my knees and I said the prayer and I got up and he started laughing. And I thought that was inappropriate. I mean, because it was a very godly moment. And I said, what are you laughing at? And he said, you don't want to give God that kind of power in your life? And I said, no. And he said, he's got all the power anyway, Bob. Whether you give it to him or not is irrelevant. This is just an exercise in who's God and who's the drunk. The book says we thought well before making this decision, knowing that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to Him. Okay? We thought well before doing this. Knowing that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to God. When I go into the third step today, I'm ready to be whatever God wants me to be. And I'm ready, you know, to be whatever God wants me to be anyway. You want to know something? After I was supposed to be dead 30 years ago. I shouldn't be alive. I mean, by every measurement, I should have passed on 30 years ago. And I have been given a life beyond my wildest dreams. You know, at the end of the fifth step, it says we can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Did you ever wonder why the hell you got that committee running in your head? I can sit absolutely alone and I don't have to get up and turn on the TV. I'll just sit there. I'll just sit. Sometimes I fall asleep. You know, but sometimes I just sit and my mind's clear and I don't have a 10-piece band going on in there. And that's all that's going on. And people look at you like, surely something's going on. It's like, no. Yeah, there's nothing going on. So he said, well, now you got to do the fourth step. And I said, right away? And he said, yeah. It says that this decision, this third step decision, would have little permanent effect unless it's at once followed by a rigorous attempt to clean the house. At once. Now, I was hoping that it was going to say, well, that was a really tough decision, and now take 2-3 months off and rest up so you can write inventory. And he said, did you bring a notebook? And I said, yes. And he said, okay, so what I want you to do is I want you to write down resentments, first of all, those are people, institutions, and principles. And you make a list and then come back and show me your list. And I said, okay. So I've been mad at almost anybody I ever met. Yeah, well, I had a bad habit. And the bad habit was I'd look at somebody and I'd try and figure out if they were better or worse than I was. Okay? And I wouldn't leave it at that. I would keep looking until they became better than I was. I don't care if it was a Bowery bum. I'd figure out some way that person was better, and then I'd resent them. So I had a lot of people on the list, and then I put institutions down like the police and the courts and some stuff like that. And I didn't know what to do with principles, and it wasn't until I was 25 years sober that I really started writing principal inventories too. But I went back and I'll talk about that in a minute, but I went back and I said, okay, well, I've got my list. And he said, now you got to write down in the second column why you're mad at him. Okay? And he said, don't spend a lot of time with that. A very short sentence will do. And I thought that was where you could really shine, you know, talking about what these people did to you. I was ready to write a book in that column. And then he said, and then I want you to write down what it affected, your self-esteem, your security, your ambitions, your personal or sex relations, your pocketbook. And I said, okay. So I did all that. And then I came back and I said, I'm through. And he said, no, you're not. And I said, what didn't I do? And he said, you didn't write a fear inventory. And I said, don't worry about it. I'm not afraid of anything. And he said, you're not. And I said, nope, I'm not. You know, I was a bill collector in Chicago, and I'm absolutely fearless. And he said, then the book must be wrong. And I said, why? And he said, because it says, fear is an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence is shot through with it. And he said, it must be wrong. And I said, yep. And he said, you're not afraid of anything, huh? And I said, nope. And he said, what about snakes? And I said, what kind of snakes? And he said, how about rattlesnakes? And I said, well, you wouldn't want to be in a closet with one. And he said, humor me and write down rattlesnakes. And I said, okay. And I wrote down snakes. And he said, how about spiders? And I said, like black widows? And he said, yeah, that'd work. And I said, well, you'd have to be a fool to want to get bit by one of those things. And he said, I agree, write down spiders. So I wrote down spiders, and then he said, how about failure? Well, everybody told me from the time I was that big that I was going to die from alcoholism like my dad, or I was going to wind up in mental institutions like my mother. And he said, write down failure. How about inadequacy? And I said, Don, I've never felt like I was as good as other people. And he said, write down inadequacy. How about women? And I said, And he said, just write down women. And he said, how about children? And I said, just a real little one, because I'm always afraid I'm going to drop them. And so he said, write down infants. How about the police? And I said, you mean like when you got a squad car right in your rearview mirror? And he goes, uh-huh. And I said, okay. And he said, write down the police. How about the courts? And I said, you know those jerks sentenced me to the Wisconsin State Penitentiary, don't you? And he said, yeah. So you can write down the courts. And then he said, is there anything you're not afraid of? And I said, I don't think so. He asked me to do, I wrote all this stuff down, and then I came back, and I said, okay, I'm through. And he said, no, now you have to write a sex inventory. And I thought, oh, this is good. You know, this is my time to shine. I went into that sex inventory thinking I was Casanova and came out looking like Elmer Fudd. Was it selfish or not? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Everything I ever did was selfish. Did you unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Absolutely. They were the tools of the trade. You know, I had such a diminished sense of self-worth that I thought if any woman ever got a good look at me, they would be out of there faster than I could spit. And so I always kept them on their heels. And I used jealousy, suspicion, and bitterness as tools to keep them off balance. And I got to tell you, that's not a good way to have a relationship. You know what? You know when I found that out? When I was 7 years sober. I'm going through it, just doing it by the numbers. Did you unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, and bitterness? Blink. Okay? Yeah. Right? So he said, right on the beginning of that, I want you to put all the take it to the grave stuff. And I said, all right. And I put down all the things that I was so ashamed that I would never of that I would never tell anybody else. When you come back tomorrow, I'll tell you about the principal inventory, because it makes a big difference. So I wrote all this stuff down and I came back and he said, well, you want to fifth step this now? And I said, yeah, well, there was a problem there because I'm a loner. Okay, always have been. I'm not a person who is easily sociable. I have a very limited number of friends. I'm just a person who is relatively uncomfortable in social settings. So here's the first guy I had really let in my adult life. And I knew that if I sat down and told him who I really was, I'll know. And so I said, I don't want to drink. So I sat down and I fist-stepped all this stuff with him. And I thought he was going to get up and he was going to say, Bob, there's a couple things I want you to do. First of all, don't tell anybody I'm your sponsor. Secondly, I don't want you anywhere near my wife or my children. And what he did? He got up and he gave me a hug and told me he loved me. Man. Yeah, I mean, having some other guy doing that is a little kind of a culture shock for me. And you know what? It was great. And somebody knew me. Today, when I 10 step with people, you call back and forth about if you're getting selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, fear. We just call somebody, and we've got friends that we 10 step with, and I've got friends in Denver that know me exactly as I am. And they know all my little idiosyncrasies and all this cheap little stuff we do, and they know me. And they still like me, and I don't know what the point is there, except I'm just amazed, all right? Because I can be so petty and so pedestrian, even today, and these guys know exactly what I'm up to, and they still hang out with me. And you know what? I do the same thing for them. And that's, do you know when the book talks about fellowship? You want to know what the fellowship is? The book talks about the fellowship of the Spirit, okay? And the fellowship of the Spirit is the common bond that grows up around people who have the common experience of doing the steps. Now, I can tell you that I can sit in a group for 5 minutes, listen to people talk, and I can tell you everyone in that group that's done the steps. It's just obvious. And if you don't believe that, it's true. You go do the steps and you will be able to tell everyone else in the room who's done them, and you can tell who the BSers are. And you want to know the truth? Likes attract in AA. And that means that step workers hang out with step workers and bullshitters hang out with bullshitters. I don't know how to make that any clearer. Okay? You know, and people in my home group say, tell them what you really mean, Bob. So I fist-stepped all this stuff, and my sponsor came over and hugged me when I was done, and he said, go home, do 6 and 7. And I went home and did 6 and 7, and I put the book up on the shelf and took it down and reviewed the first 5 steps and asked myself if I was willing to be rid of all of those things which we had found were objectionable. And I thought it was pretty solid so far. And I was really willing to let anything go that God didn't want in my life. And then I said the 7-step prayer. You know, that whole thing takes 2 paragraphs in the book. And I said the 7-step prayer, which is now about now, I'm ready that you have all me good and bad. Grant me strength as I go out here and do thy bidding. And I said the 7-step prayer, and I honestly felt at that point in my life that I started recovering. There are a lot of people that have a feeling at that point in their recovery that something's really happened. And it comes at different points for different people, but a lot of them feel that way in the 7-step. And then it says we made a list of all of persons we had harmed, became willing to make amends to them all. And the next line in there is very curious. It says, we did it when we took inventory. Okay? Now, that's a curious thing to say, because if you go take somebody else's inventory form, you don't come up with the same thing. Now, there's an outline in this book, the fifth chapter, I won't look it up now, but there's an outline in this book about how to write inventory. And see, everybody comes into Alcoholics Anonymous and wants to put their thumbprint on this thing. And so they change it around a little bit, and it's, you know, all of us have a tendency to do that in us. We go, well, that'd be nice, but this would be better. And if you take inventory like it's described in this book, when you got your damn near your whole 8-step list, that's what happens. And so you take that list and you go through there, and sometimes there's a few more people that you don't have resentment against, but that you harmed, and you put them on the list. And then what I did was I went back to my sponsor and I showed him my list, and then he sat down and he said, I want to know what the harm is in each one of those situations. Because I don't want you going to those people to make amends to them and not know what the hell you did. You know, and a lot of people just think they're so bad they must have harmed everybody, so they go around making apologies to everybody. That's not what this is about. Okay? This is about making direct amends, which means that you go out and balance the books. One of the worst ones that I had to make was to my father. I hated my father. My father was a chronic alcoholic, and he was violent, and he scared the hell out of me. And I went to my sponsor, and he said, what are you going to do about your dad? And I said, nothing. So why not? And I said, he's living in a Grand Army home in King, Wisconsin. He's had a really serious stroke. He can't communicate. He's not supposed to have any kind of continuous thought at all. And so if I go make amends to him, he isn't even going to hear it. What's the point? And he said, this is about cleaning off your side of the street, Bob. And that means you pack up your fanny and get in the car and go to Wisconsin and make amends to him whether he understands or not. That's the kind of loving sponsorship I had. Genghis Khan Jr. So I got in the car and I went to the Grand Army home in King, Wisconsin, and you know, my dad was a big old tough guy. And here's this little old gray-haired man sitting in a wheelchair, and he's paralyzed from the waist down and on one side. And he can't speak. And I walk in there and I said, well, his name's Bob Olson too. And I went in there and I said, I'm looking for Bob Olson. They said, that's him. And I walked over to him and I said, hi. He looked up at me and had kind of a quizzical look. And I said, I'm your son, Bob. And he looked like something was going on in there. And I said, I wanna talk with you. I need to make amends to you. And I wheeled him off into this little room and sat down in front of him. And I said, I've harmed you. I have held you at arm's length my whole life because you were an alcoholic. And I regret having done that, and I'm willing to do anything to make that right. And I am an alcoholic. And when he heard that I was an alcoholic, he really became sad. And I said, but I don't drink anymore. And I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of the things we do is we come and we try and make good the harm that we've caused other people. And I have harmed you. It was not very long after that that he was truly incapable of understanding anything. And he died shortly thereafter. And I got to tell you, I'm glad I went and did that, because I don't know how I would have done that if he wouldn't have been there. And if you got amends, don't put them off. You may not last, or they may not last, and it's time. I owed a lot of money. It took me 2.5 years. Pay off $15,000. That was in 1975 that I paid it off finally. Not too many years after that, I had a business that failed. I wound up $250,000 in debt. And it was paid off in 90 days. I didn't know how that was ever going to happen. I despaired of it. And I went to my sponsor and I said, how can that happen? It took 2.5 years to pay off $15,000 and I paid off $250,000 in 90 days. How'd that happen? How do you explain that? He said, it doesn't require explanation. And I said, why not? And he said, God's got all the money he needs. Okay. I don't know. Okay. One day I was clean. One day I didn't have to cross the street to avoid anybody. 10th step is about continuing to watch for selfishness and dishonesty, resentment and fear. When you see it, you ask God at once to remove it. You talk to someone about it, you make amends if you've harmed someone, and then you resolutely turn your thoughts to someone you can help. The trick in the 10th step is, number one, talking to someone else about it. It's a good way to get perspective. And it's a good way to be reminded by your 10th step friends about, did you ask God to remove it? Okay? Which means, did you turn to God? The other part of it, the part that really is neat, is resolutely turning our thoughts to someone we can help. See, when we get into selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear, we get internalized again, and for us, that's death. So we need to turn out. And the way I turn out is by resolutely turning my thoughts to someone I can help. Then I'm thinking about you and I'm not thinking about me. 11 is about discipline. Talks about what you do when you get up in the morning. God, please show me all through the day what my next step is to be. Give me whatever I need to take care of the problems. We review our plans for the day. I make plans at night. I write down 10 or 15 things at night. It's just a really good thing to do. And I get up in the morning and I have all these plans and then I review them. Sometimes I change them and sometimes I don't. You know why that's really good? Because most people get out of bed going, oh hell, what's going to happen today? Okay? And if you got a plan, that doesn't happen. And it gets your anxiety level down about 50%. It talks about when we go to bed at night, we review our day. Did we harm someone? Is there an amend that we need to make? It talks about what we do as we go through the day. We pause when agitated or doubtful and ask for the right thought or action. It says we have these attitudes, I will not, mine be done, and I'm not running the show anymore. And what the 11 steps really about is discipline. And in the end of it, it says, in this way God disciplines us. But it's about turning to God all through the day and keeping our life on a spiritual basis. And 12, you know, everybody thinks the 12th step is about going out and helping other people, and a big part of it is, but the other part of it is practicing these principles in all our affairs. And that means you're going to live a spiritual life, or aren't you? You know, a guy asked me not too long ago, a guy asked me, what do you stand for? And I said, I'm not sure. And he said, then you don't stand for anything. And I started thinking about what I stood for. And I found out that if you're going to carry a message in this program, make sure that it's clear and make sure that it's precise and make sure that you are unafraid. And you know why you should be unafraid? Because most people in Alcoholics Anonymous don't want to hear it. Isn't that an awful thing to say? But see, you're going to walk into a meeting, I guarantee you, I'll bet you serious money. You're going to walk into a meeting and you can say what's in the big book. You can say, I can show you precisely how to recover. You know, you ought to see what kind of response you get off of that. Okay? They're going to think you magnanimous SOP. Don't come around here with that bullshit. You want to know the truth? I can show you precisely how to recover. And have done that with hundreds of people. So, what do I stand for? What are my principles? How is it that I want to live? Do I want to go out scamming people like I spent the first part of my life doing? No. You know what I want to do? I want to live a principled life. That's what I want to do. I never knew I could do that. I want to live a principled life. And I want to put others' welfare above my own. Otherwise, I guarantee you I wouldn't be out here tonight. I wouldn't. I'd be playing golf in Denver. I want to carry a clear message. I want you to understand in no uncertain terms that there is a solution, and the solution is a lot more than not drinking. I want my life to mean something. When this thing's all over, you know, I was in a hospital 8 years ago going in and out of a coma. And you know what I thought about? Did you make 1 ounce of difference in life? Is anybody's life 1 ounce better because you've been here for the last 50-some years? You're going to have to answer that question too. I hope you got an answer. So, you know, I really appreciate being asked out here, and we're going to have this thing tomorrow. And, you know, if you folks are the way you've been described to me, you can become a driving force in this community for recovery. You truly can. If you will engage in this process, and you will go show other people how to recover based on the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous as they're written, you can virtually polarize this whole area, and you will make it a place where people with alcoholism don't have to die anymore. And you want to know something? That is a wonderful way to spend your life. And along the way, while you're doing that, you'll be just amazed at what God gives you. Okay? Thanks anyway for listening.